I'm Dave Williams, you're listening to ACB Radio's Main Menu, and I'm joined this week by Michael Fair and Ron Schemmerhorn, the former and current editors of the Odyssey magazine, respectively. We'll get to you, Ron, shortly, but I'd like to start with Mike and talk about, Mike, you yourself are blind and edited the Odyssey magazine. Just firstly, before we get to Odyssey, let's talk about life before Odyssey. When was the first time you used a computer, and when was the first time you had the idea that actually it was possible to play games on a computer if you were blind? Because if I was to say to a guy in a bar, I'm going to go home and perhaps chill out and play a couple of computer games, they're probably going to look at me and think, hang on, blind guy, computer games, what's that all about?
Yeah, and that's still quite an issue. Not too many people really know about them. Like, we've tried to spread the word, and I think Odyssey's doing a good job of starting that, but there's still games. I think what it really boils down to is when we get computers, a lot of the times no one really bothers to sort of tell blind people what they can do with them, and that really has sheltered a lot of people from really realizing just how powerful a force games can be in life. I started, my first computer was an Apple IIe. I was about 10 years old, and I played my first game one school night. It was called Great Escape, and any Apple IIe users will probably be very familiar with it. You were in a maze of 100 rooms, and you had to find your way out, and basically there was a villain that chased you and would take your gold coins if he caught you. There was a leprechaun you could find, a gorilla that would whip you upside the head, a medical kit, just a bunch of odds and ends. It was a very bizarre, surreal kind of game. And I actually wrote about that in the first issue of Odyssey. I believe the thing was called the 8-Bit Adventure or something. And that was how it started for me. And because of the foresight of that school teacher, Mrs. Wade, at the time, she, I guess, didn't realize fully sort of how far that would take me. And I guess since then, growing up, games have really been a cornerstone of my life, and I've learned quite a lot from them. I see them as journeys, really. You know, we go on a trip, we can enjoy ourselves, and we can also take a lot of hard, really good lessons back that we can apply to the rest of our lives. And games are the same kind of thing, only in the mind. And that's basically my philosophy about them. And Odyssey came later. I really wanted to sort of share my experience with games and try to, broaden the scope of it and hear what other people had to say. Because I knew what I thought of all the games I played, but I had no idea what other people would think if they had the opportunity.
Right. Let's just focus on the mechanics, if you will, of playing a game if you're blind. Obviously, if I want to get to the end of my road, I'm going to pick up my cane and go. And that's the tool that enables me to access the world, I guess, in a sense. And obviously, my Windows applications, I'm using a screen reader to use those. I mean, take the Great Escape there that you just mentioned. How did you use that game? Was it a self-voicing game? Was it through interaction using sounds, or were you using a screen reading program? Because there are different approaches, aren't there? And we can perhaps explore the relative merits of those approaches.
Absolutely. Great Escape was a straight text-based adventure. So you basically were read the text by your speech software and speech synthesizer. Back on the Apple, it was an old Echo speech synthesizer. And you type in your commands. Great Escape was really a dirt simple kind of thing. It was north, south, east, west, one-letter commands. You didn't even have to type whole words or yes-no answers. It was that dirt simple. And we've seen that develop, over the years to a spectacular degree until probably 96, 97. Basically, we were into text games. Everything was straight text. Only, of course, the parsers got better. We saw the Infocom adventures, where you basically have to type in commands and it would read back a story and it could understand whole sentences if you typed them in. And those I really got into when I had the Eureka A4. I guess I got that around 89 or 90. And sort of my mid-high school, I guess, beginning to middle high school days. And they also the other thing with Eureka, it had a virtual screen so that you could examine row and column positions of things, and through that virtual screen, another kind of game, a role-playing adventure called Rogue, came to my attention, and I actually wrote an article about that in the Archimedes newsletter. It basically presented you with a map made of text symbols that you could read over with your screen reader and map out in your mind the dimensions of a dungeon room, and then take your character through it and decide, okay, I'll move this way and kill this monster, and it was all keyboard commands. You just had to memorize the different commands to make your character do the different things. And it was all done with punctuations and symbols and things, like you were the at sign and monsters were different letters. So that was a whole other avenue of game that has developed over the years. And of course, nowadays, with Windows, things have just blossomed incredibly in terms of arcade stuff. When I was a kid, my father and I went to the arcade, and we would play, he would explain to me in the arcade what was happening in the game, and let me control the joystick and telling me, oh, there's a ship coming to the left, head that way and shoot, and or, you know, head right and do this. And we had endless fun doing that, but I kept thinking to myself, gee, I'd love to just sit down and play one of these things myself, completely independently. And as much fun as we had with it, that was always a real wish of mine. And now, thanks to a lot of real smart people, it's coming true. And we can play Space Invaders and Pac-Man and Pong and all the rest of them now with complete stereo or even surround sound. It's tremendously freeing. The possibilities that are open to us now, it's the moon's the limit now. It's incredible.
Essentially, a computer game is a piece of software, obviously. And the way in which you interact with that software, is a challenge if you're a blind person. You've really outlined two broad areas, really. You mentioned the Infocom games, which were text-based adventures where you would get some information about the room and the objects in it, and then you could, you know, tell the game what you wanted to do, and there would be a narrative that would follow through the game. And those, it was almost like an interactive, you guys call it interactive fiction. And I think that's a very apt description. And then you've got sort of the sound-based games. When did they really begin to emerge? You mentioned the Eureka, which I guess was the PDA of its day. You know, it was the Braille note, the Braille light of its time. It didn't have a Braille display, and some would say that its synthetic voice was particularly horrible. But I was a fan of the Eureka, and it was in some respects, I guess, ahead of its time. I was talking to somebody the other day about the game Aliens, and that was really, to my mind, one of the first games, and I mean, I'm sure you're aware of others and certainly provide examples, but that was certainly one of the first games that really made very little use of sort of speech and text. It was, you know, it was mostly a game that you kind of played in the, you know, sort of in the sound domain, using sound effects as the, as a way to communicate information from, you know, to the player.
Oh, yes, the Aliens game on the Eureka was definitely the first of the Space Invaders games that we actually could play, and it was a monotone, it didn't have stereo sound, it had a single mono speaker, but it made use of the musical scale, so instead of left to right, you moved left to right, but it made the notes go higher and lower, and then you heard the ships, the notes of the ships, and you just had to match them and shoot. It was great, and you heard the command ships moving across. That game just ate up ages of my time. Probably cost me a good deal of my school marks at some points. And that was the first inkling of what sound could do in a game situation that I had. I would imagine what it would be like if games were made using stereo sound, even back as a 12-year-old kid. But that was my first real taste of the kind of coordination, the arcade-style coordination that sighted people have experienced since like the late 70s, basically. And now at this stage, like, I guess Aliens was, I think, the only sound-based game for the Eureka that I really have solid memories of. I don't remember any sort of further development, although I'm sure you could have done more with it. Like you said, it was way ahead of its time in so many areas. But with DOS, with the PCS, they made some DOS games. They were the first company that contacted me, and they had a bunch of, they had a racing game. They did a tank game, their first, I think it was Panzers in North Africa or something like that. Had a racing game, football, a few others. They were, of course, a lot more simple then than things are now. They had a DOS Windows Pac-Man version. That was the first kind of DOS to Windows hybrid they did. And now, of course, with the Windows coming in, we have everything in taking more full advantage of the stereo sound and the surround sound capabilities of some systems. I know for most people, stereo sound would be the limit, the two speakers, because it can be expensive to get surround sound equipment. And now, of course, we have the capability to exploit it, and maybe that'll eventually induce more people to invest the money and get more expensive equipment. There was a thread about that on the Blind Gamers list a while ago, and it'll be interesting to see what happens, whether games can drive people to buy hardware to play them in the blind community. I'm not at all sure which way that'll go yet, but we certainly have come a heck of a long way in a relatively short time.
When blind people started playing computer games, and again, I refer to the Infocom games, they weren't games that were written specifically for the blind player. They were mainstream games that were, you know, aimed at a mainstream market, largely because the technology at that time was limited in that, you know, out there graphics and things weren't yet possible. But then I think we saw a parting of the ways to a certain extent that games did become very visual, and it became increasingly difficult for blind people to access mainstream games. And I guess there's now, there are sort of two types of games out there. There are the mainstream games, some of which are accessible, and feel free to identify, you know, particular titles which are notable for their accessibility. And then, of course, you've got games from folks like Bavisoft, the games specifically designed for blind people, which I think, if we're going to be brutally honest, are probably not particularly appealing to the sighted player, because they want to, you know, they want these sexy graphics.
Absolutely, and that split I think has gotten is still on its way to getting worse, because the market force isn't there for them to make it accessible, even when it would be relatively easy to do. For instance, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the second version of that came out one Christmas, was a terrible disappointment to a lot of people on the Odyssey list, because everyone thought, oh, we're going to have Regis reading out the questions and we can just answer them with a keyboard. And unfortunately, the questions were printed up on the screen. So, and it was printed, of course, in a way that the screen readers couldn't read, because it was fancy characters that are drawn on the screen versus the normal way Windows would print. So due to that, it was a completely inaccessible game, and that kind of thing really always gets to me when I find out about things like that. It really, for these games, like, there are a few mainstream games. Certainly, the interactive fiction isn't really designed to be for the blind. It's all designed for sighted people. And even the stuff today, now we have a new company called Malinch that is making interactive fiction popular again and commercial again. They're selling it. And they've done, I think they've just completed their third game. It was a naval thriller, and they're working on their fourth. They have a mystery in a mental institution. A few other things, and he's really trying to push that back into the mainstream. And for a while, interactive fiction also got harder to play, because for some synthesizers, some screen readers, it was harder to actually control it and to have it read properly. Now, of course, there's steps being taken to come out with a program that'll make a lot of these games more accessible. And I hope when that information, when they've really got that sort of nailed down, that we'll see that in the issue of Odyssey coming out after that, because that's going to put interactive fiction hopefully back on the map again solidly for more people. It won't even matter if they have a screen reader or not. And that's the kind of thing that'll make it more accessible games from the mainstream available to us if efforts like that are taken. If we can get people to see that, oh, there are blind people that would enjoy this out there. Because a lot of the stuff that we found that is text-based, no one knows about. Like, no one thinks, oh, this would be helpful to blind people, because they're just not thinking of us. We don't sort of, we're not on their radar at all. And it's only thanks to the companies like Babisoft and Adore Entertainment has done some spectacular arcade game kind of thing. Bowling from PCS. PCS Games has really reemerged. GMA Games is certainly up there. A lot of these companies are doing really fantastic work. And you can't compare, really, to sighted game, like the amount of resources that are put into these games, and the amount of the economics are just completely different for developing accessible games to developing a mainstream title. And I don't see that sort of changing anytime soon. But despite that, yeah, especially if you have someone sighted that can help you, there are a lot of games out there that that can be enjoyable.
Who is Michael Fair? What's your background, Mike? What, before you, you know, we'll get to Odyssey in a moment and talk about the online, so the blind gaming community, but what's your background? What were you doing in the 80s?
Oh, enjoying myself like everyone else, really, and growing up and learning life's lessons. I was entering high school at the later 80s, that would be 89, 88, 89 in that range. I basically went to boarding school for a couple years. In Canada, they had a boarding school for the blind. And after that, after the 2.5 years I spent at that school, I switched to a school in Toronto, Ontario, called Hollywood Public School. It makes it sound like some posh place with stars and stuff, but it wasn't. It was just an ordinary public school with a very special pilot program in it that put two blind classes in the sighted school. So you got the social interaction, the social conditions of a normal school in the normal world, and you got the specialized attention you needed to learn the skills that you as a blind person needed. And that was how I spent up to grade 6 in that school. And then from then on, I was in complete public school. I was the only blind person in the institutions I went to, R.J. Lang and Meadowvale Secondary School. And really, that's, I guess, with because of that, I was exposed to the whole slew of cultural forces at work. And I saw as games were hitting the sighted world from the early 80s onward, I appreciated how much people were getting from them and how much we were learning from them. Like, people didn't really learn computers from the courses we took in school or from, you know, typing in class or something. They learned it by playing games. You know, they learned it having fun. And those are the people now that, have come up and really made a difference in the world, are the people who had that exposure to all the technical fun that became available to them. And as I grew up, I got exposed to more of the text games and things and had a lot of really good positive experiences from them. And because of that, in 96 or so, that was when Odyssey started, July of 96, I was just bored out of my skull one summer and couldn't think of anything to do. And I was first year university, or second, yeah. I graduated in 98, so it would have been, first year university or second. And, it's hard to find, summer jobs or anything like that. So I was just home at summer, and it was 4 months. You get 4 months off in university before the next term starts. So long stretch of time. And I just thought, okay, well, let's try to start a magazine. I just wrote down my initial thoughts and sort of an introduction of what I'd hoped the magazine would become, and put some of my thoughts about games out there and sent it out. And that was, just out of sheer boredom, that's how it started. And it just took off fairly quickly, a lot more than I ever thought it would.
Okay. Just a little bit more on you, Mike. What did you read at university?
Well, I'm an English major. Words have always been my strong point. And I'm an avid reader. I read tons and tons of fantasy, science fiction. I try to keep up with world news and everything. And I've always sort of been like that, even as a younger kid. I was kind of the nerd in a lot of the settings in school. People would sort of come to me for anything that required, someone to think through ethics, different things like that, or world issues or different things, computers. I knew a lot more than a lot of people at that time. especially about bulletin boards and things, because I was into those. I was using my modem and goofing off online, and it was those were kind of neat days with online games you could play. They were all text-based too, Trade Wars and all that, and you could just get into all these neat space adventures and different things. And also it helped in school, of course. I was using encyclopedia and things online to get some articles, and it really helped. I always sort of knew more than a lot of kids my age, and in the academic sense, but in the social sense, I was a bit behind until I really got to university. And that's where I really discovered what it meant to really belong in a place and to have a place that you could really make a positive difference, you can help people with. And that probably sort of shaped how I wanted Odyssey to go as well, because it was part of me. I really realized how much it can mean to you if you have the power to reach out and help people and change their lives. And that, from the beginning, I wanted Odyssey to be that. I wanted Odyssey to be something that would help people have a chance to do that, have a chance to step up to the plate and contribute to something that was sort of larger than themselves. And I guess Odyssey really was my first test of that. I've always wanted to. As a kid growing up, I kept thinking, oh, I wish there was something really large I could sort of get involved in and do. And if you're blind, the opportunities to really do that are sort of few and far between. And that was a real treat for me to see that really blossom.
Odyssey is a magazine for blind gamers, essentially. And has really, it seems, has probably exceeded any expectations that you may have had. How did you get from having, you know, nothing to do one summer and you know, scribbling down a few paragraphs to having a magazine that's been read around the world by, you know, by hundreds of people?
Well, I didn't do it alone. That's what it boils down to. I wrote the first issue and published it on a small bulletin board called CompuServe. It was actually quite a large sort of system. It had these sort of divisions that would sort of branch off into different forums. There were forums, not bulletin boards. And I went to the disability forum, which was sort of a separate area specialized in disability related things. And you'd have message boards and you'd have files. And I just uploaded the text file of the magazine into the system there, and thought, okay, well, first issue's done, and what's going to come of it? I hope I get some response, but I'm really not expecting much. And I started getting emails from people, and the initial reaction was quite positive on CompuServe. Now, at the same time, I should mention I published it on the CNIB, Canadian National Institute for the Blind in Canada. They ran a service called Sky Club, which I believe is still in operation today. And it was just an email list that you could join that you could send message, and they have discussions that would be ongoing on different things. And I thought this would be a handy thing for people to know about, that they could have games to play on their machines. So I sent this fairly large first issue, it must have been 28 pages or something, through the email list, and started quite a flame war. A lot of people felt that Odyssey was great and they loved it, which sort of certainly did wonders for my ego. And a lot of people thought I'd really caused a lot of grief by doing this, because I guess in some areas at that time, and this might still be true, some people pay for by the byte that they download, kind of thing. So you download something that you're not expecting, and it actually costs you money. And that I had no idea, of course, that this could be the case. And by the time I'd found out, it was hard, because of course I'd done all this hard work. I'd made the magazine, sent it out, and I thought, great, I'm doing everyone a favor. And it turned out, of course, that I wasn't doing everyone a favor, and some people legitimately didn't care about games and didn't want this big thing in their inbox, and it caused quite a back and forth on that list. But amid all the chaos, it did get out, and another person, JJ Medog, and also Travis Siegel, found it fairly early on, and they were the ones that really helped get Odyssey its own email list. for people who genuinely wanted it and would sign up for it. And as that happened, I would send an off CompuServe out onto this other list, and they would, it would just, I just literally have to send it to this one email address, and they would take care of all the rest, and they managed the subscriptions and every, all the other shenanigans associated with maintaining an email list. And thank goodness for that, because I don't think I would have had the stamina for to do both myself at that time. And I just kept writing issue after issue, and it just grew.
And we'll continue the Odyssey story next week on Main Menu.